ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, the Albanese government brings down the federal budget on Tuesday week, and voters no doubt expect significant cost of living relief measures. But what about the I word, inflation? Treasurer Jim Chalmers seems very sensitive at the moment to suggestions that imminent budget measures may feed inflation. In a press conference today, he pushed back on such fears, saying that that assessment was too blunt, his words, and he indicated the budget will be more expansionary than contractionary, while emphasising the need for balance.
This is not the time for scorched earth austerity. It would not be wise, when people are doing it tough and when the economy is soft, for us to slash and burn in this budget. This is not the time to slash and burn in the budget when people are doing it tough and when growth in our economy is weaker than we would like it to be.
Well, of course, the other factor is the Reserve Bank Board is meeting tomorrow and will no doubt be seriously considering lifting interest rates in the months ahead if domestic inflation continues to prove more sticky than hoped. Joining us once again for Nightlife News Breakdown, Hugh Rimmington, National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. Hugh, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, the Treasurer does seem a bit touchy on this issue, doesn't he?
It is a wicked problem, isn't it? Because middle Australia is squeezed between higher prices, known as inflation, and higher interest rates, which is designed to fix inflation. And whatever the government does to put, you know, money into pockets tends to be inflationary. Jim Chalmers says that's probably too simplistic and blunt as a mechanism to understand what's going on. But in simple terms, and blunt as it is, that is what's happening. And economists have been lining up to tell us that if, you know, essentially the argument with dealing with inflation and interest rates is to try to have monetary policy, that's the stuff that's set by the Reserve Bank, and fiscal policy, that's the spending and savings measures that the government puts together, pulling in the same direction. So if there's too much expansionary spending to help people, it tends to work against what the Reserve Bank is trying to do. And, you know, that probably is a bit blunt and simplistic, but it's still fundamentally true, and it is the dilemma that the government's got. And the language you're going to hear from the Reserve Bank tomorrow afternoon, I think, is going to be really, really important, because it is probable that they'll do two things. They'll leave interest rates where they are for now, but there will definitely be, you'd expect on what, you know, economists out in the wider world are saying, some sharpening of the language about the dangers of inflation, that too many of the surprises have been happening on the wrong side of the ledger when it comes to inflation, and there'll be a little warning out there coming from the Reserve Bank, and that's going to constrain the Treasurer. Plainly, it is constraining the Treasurer, but not so much that they're going to go in panic and go austerity on us.
Sure. Well, like all budgets, Hugh, most of the good stuff gets leaked beforehand, and sometimes the hard stuff gets leaked beforehand too. And that's continued with this budget. The HECS, or help relief, announced on the weekend. Look, it's not huge, but it's significant. Some relief for students who, with their student loans. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare announced new financial supports for students completing unpaid placements too, those studying nursing, teaching, midwifery and social work. They're going to be eligible for $319 a week while they work on compulsory placements for their university studies. And he also says that there might be even more in store.
Time after time, when I've spoken to students who are teaching students and nursing students and social work students as well, they've told me that often they've got to give up their part-time job in order to do their prac. Placement poverty is a real thing.
Yeah, it is. Hugh, it's another measure, I guess, where you think this should always have been happening, shouldn't it? And will it help address the shortage of these skilled workers? Might both of these things actually mean more younger voters vote Labor?
Yeah, well, look, there are a few things going on there. There's separate mechanisms. The HECS thing is interesting. Bruce Chapman, who was essentially the author of HECS way back, an economist, makes the point that it doesn't mean that you're going to get a saving in your pocket, because you pay your HECS back as a proportion of your income once you reach the threshold where you've got to start returning HECS. So what the effect of this will be is that it will shorten the amount of time you're paying your HECS off because it won't accumulate to a higher level. But the actual weekly amount or monthly or whatever it is, or it's not that. The amount of money that goes out of your pocket is the same. It's just that you're paying it off faster because it's not going up higher because it's not tied to a higher indexed rate. That might sound a bit complicated, but if he's right and he should know, then having the effect that people really want for it, which is some more money in the pocket, doesn't apply. Mm. It's still welcome because it helps people see an end to their HECS debt. So there's that. The actual PRAC is good policy to give help to people because people who have got their own private means can do PRACs. It's like unpaid internships. And it cuts out the very people who don't have parents and other support structures that essentially can fund them through their training. And given that, you know, if you look at, say, teachers, for example, there is a high attrition rate once teachers come out in the first 5 years where they actually leave the teaching workforce. Now, if you add to that those who give up while they're still in their degree phase because they can't afford the PRAC, then that's a bad result. Yeah. So that does seem like it's sensible. It's not a vast sum of money, but I think it will, you know, certainly make a difference.
Yep, it will. That is true, I think. Look, on to other issues. I mean, some of the biggest issues are not getting addressed and won't be addressed in the budget either. Two of those concern housing. That's rents and house prices. I mean, the federal government's concerns about cost of living pressures would not have been eased today with news that rental prices across Australia are yet another record high. The national median weekly rent is now $627, following a 0.8% rise in April. This is according to CoreLogic. It's sort of terrible news for renters, isn't it? And a problem for the government that isn't going away, and frankly, they're not actually offering anything to make it go away, are they?
No, and it also goes to the difficulty of actually sorting these problems because inflation is a basket of a whole bunch of things, and the way in which you try to bring down inflation is to put up interest rates. One of the things that putting up interest rates does, of course, is it puts up people who are landlords who are borrowing money see their costs going up, and so they might try to recover it through putting up rents. And so it has that effect where because inflation is high, your rent goes up. Which seems doubly cruel. And the numbers that you've got there, yes, if you're trying to get down to, as the Reserve Bank must, try to get down to an overall point that it's aiming at, is the midpoint between 2 and 3%, and its inflation target band, it now says that they're looking for that to happen in 2026. Well, you can't do that if rents, they're only one component, but if rents are running at 8% plus, then that's a problem. And if you actually look through those figures, they're very lumpy. So if 8.4 is the national figure, you've got these areas where there's high high migration. This is both external migration into areas, but also internal migration from other parts of the country or across cities. So just to give you one example, on the CoreLogic data that was out today, the northern section of the CBD of Melbourne, so around North Melbourne and those suburbs, rents have gone up by 29% in the last year. Mm. And they have had a double whammy on the figures of both internal migration and external migration. Students are coming back. Lots of, you know, we've had the population of Australia rose 2.5% in the year to September 2023. 2.5% in a year, 660,000 people. And many of those have gone into Melbourne and Sydney. To a lesser degree, but certainly not an insignificant degree, to Brisbane. And then you're seeing internal migration, people essentially kind of giving up on these, the big cities. And you're seeing things like the northern reaches of Perth around Alkimos, Eglinton. They've got a very strong inward migration, internal migration going into those places. And so that's everyone's trying to find somewhere where they can live and can afford it, and people are moving to try to find it where they can, and this is there is an enormous amount of strain. How can there not be strain? Rents have gone up in some parts of the country at 29%.
That's right. That's right. On house prices and rents, as I say, the government's really offering nothing. I'm not saying it's a simple problem. It's not.
No. They've got this. They came in with this promise of 1.2 million extra houses. There's no way they're going to meet that in the time that they've done it. Everyone acknowledges that's the case. There's plenty of blame to go around, from councils to state governments to just the sheer economics, labour shortages, land release issues. You can go on and on, and people have gone on and on about it. But whatever happens is it's added up to not enough properties and places where people need them in these steepening rents.
Exactly. Look, to Qantas, the company's reached a deal with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, to settle a lawsuit. This is against the airline for selling ghost flights. That is, they sold seats on flights that the airline knew that they'd already cancelled. Now, Qantas has agreed to compensate customers, and they'll pay in total a penalty of $100 million. The chief executive of Qantas, Vanessa Hudson, says the company wants to restore its reputation, and the settlement's an important part of its strategy to regain the trust of customers.
I think that this is really important for us to have settled with the ACCC, important to be able to compensate customers that were impacted, important to enable us to move forward in the work that we've been doing to rebuild trust with customers.
Yes, well, trust with customers might be a long and distant dawn. Hugh, I think Qantas customers might think it very important for Qantas to keep fares down, not try and recover the $100 million from passengers' purses. But is it a deserved punishment?
Oh, absolutely. This was appalling behaviour. Mm. It was – what the technique was is you claim to have flights that are going, you get people to sign up to it. You never intended to fly that plane. Qantas then contacts the customer bank, says, oh, sorry, we've had to cancel the flight. We can offer you a range of other flights, and we can put the fare you've already paid towards that flight. There may be some cost changes associated with it, blah, blah. It may cost you more. And, oh, hell, by that stage, the person's committed to Qantas, and they've already got a financial investment in flying on them because they've now got the credit on the flight. And so they accept that for all the disruption. Whereas had they known at the start that Qantas wasn't intending to put on that 7 p.m. flight from Melbourne to Canberra, or whatever it was, they could have gone to Virgin and quite happily flown off with them or some other carrier. So this, to say nothing of things like, connecting flights that were missed, accommodation that was blown out. This comes, to my mind, it's morally criminal. Plainly, it's not counter.
Yeah, I entirely agree with you, and I don't understand why Qantas isn't wearing more heat for it, quite frankly.
Yes, and the thing about this is that it was known as a deliberate policy within Qantas.
Yeah, they clearly
and was doubtless approved of, and the people who were using these great sneaky little devices to completely shaft your own customer base in order to squeeze every dollar out of them would doubtless have been rewarded within the system. And we saw that Alan Joyce was richly rewarded with all of this. And really it is corrupt conduct. So I think they got away lightly with $100 million, to be perfectly honest. Mm. And it's interesting because what you see here, it's a bit like when you went back to the Banking and Finance Royal Commission, that a whole bunch of appalling practices were brought to light that could not stand in the light of day. And a whole bunch of CEOs lost their jobs, and there were clean outs out of the whole things, and lots of sober faces going, oh, mea culpa, we shouldn't have done it. We'll look deeply at ourselves and do better. But they set structures which looked at reward for things which improved the bottom line and did not have within them a business of measuring actual ethical behavior. Their moral compass had gone spinning off the dial.
That's right.
And that happened at Qantas under Alan Joyce. And it's still sorting its way back out through that, as other places have done it. It really is appalling.
A couple of things before you go. Hugh Rivington's with us, National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. Leading the news breakdown tonight, the Israeli army has ordered Tens of thousands of people in the southern Gaza city of Rafah to start evacuating the area. I mean, it's all pretty ominous, isn't it? I mean, people aren't... Everyone's not going to be able to get away, and their future is uncertain, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Netanyahu's been threatening to do this. So the talks have been going on, but they've plainly failed. Hamas says that it won't release the hostages unless there's an end to the war. That's not acceptable to Israel, which says it just simply hands Hamas the victory. Today was, or yesterday, I think, local time, was the Holocaust Remembrance Day. Netanyahu gave a speech at the big ceremony at the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem, at which he some of it was in Hebrew, but he went to English to make the point plainly for a global audience that Israel sees it is, again, up against genocidal enemies. And he could not be more bullish about it. And there was a clear statement from the Israeli Defense Minister that the new action in Rafah, where there's 1.4 million Palestinians crowded in because of they've been squeezed down there from other military actions in the north, will go ahead. Now, there was something interesting happened today, and that was that the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had a conversation with the Israeli Defense Secretary, Yoav Gallant. And there was what they call a readout from the U.S. Defense Department, which just gives you a kind of a note of what was discussed. And in it, Austin, it's interesting here, I'll quote the readout. Austin stressed the need for any potential Israeli military escalation in Rafah to include a credible plan to evacuate Palestinian civilians and maintain the flow of humanitarian aid, and then reiterated the U.S. commitment to supporting Israel's defense. So have a look at that, and that looks a lot like a nod and a wink. We don't want you to go in and do this thing, but if you're going to do it, just make sure you include a credible plan to evacuate Palestinian civilians. Yeah. So I think what we're seeing is, whether it's window dressing or, you know, something better than that, they plan to do it. And so there is this, so we're now witnessing a so-called credible plan to evacuate Palestinian civilians. But UNICEF says that where they're being told to go in Khan Yunus, which is just to the north, and also to the Masawi, which is this humanitarian zone they've laid out, just basically a sandy expanse next to the sea there, which is just
well, there's some pictures of it. It's just a tent city on sand dunes.
Yes, and they're saying Khan Yunus, and as UNICEF says, there's nothing in Khan Yunus but rubble. There's nowhere for them to go there. So it appalling and terrifying as it is, it could well be that the horrors in Gaza may not yet be over. First stage.
Look, just finally, quickly before you go, Hugh, breaking news coming through about this Chinese-Australian Air Force intersection. It looks like a Chinese jet, well, the Australian government is saying a Chinese jet's dropped flares in front of an Australian helicopter, which was on UN-assisted mission in the South China Sea, and they say there was nearly an accident. They've remonstrated hugely with the Chinese. It's not a good development. This follows on from an earlier incident involving submariners with the Australian Navy as well, doesn't it?
It fits with the pattern. It was off Korea, but in international waters, and the Australian helicopter pilot had to take evasive action to avoid being hit by the flares that were being dropped, and completely unacceptable, says the Defence Minister Richard Marles, And he's right.
Exactly. All right. We thought things were improving, but anyway, maybe the US Naval Defence Force, the Chinese Naval Force hasn't got the message. Hugh, always good to talk. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.